Lawmakers are starting day two of the special session Governor Bill Walker called. Most of the work the governor wants lawmakers to deal with directly relates to finding a path to fiscal stability. The governor wants legislators to consider new revenue in the form of taxes and a plan to restructure the permanent fund to use some of the earnings to pay for the state budget. It would also possibly reduce the size of the permanent fund dividend. Our guests say no way to reducing that dividend check. So what's their plan? We'll find out on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and today we're back to discussing the state budget. Who should pay for state government in Alaska? Oil income took care of it so easily for so long that many Alaskans may not have spent much time thinking about whether no income tax, state sales tax, or other taxes was a sustainable way to move into the future in the long term. Now, almost all Alaskans are discussing what should happen with state spending. Cutting the budget has been a big part of what's been called for, as well as raising taxes and cutting credits, subsidies, and other incentive programs that have gone to the oil and gas industry. And then there's the permanent fund. It's a big pot of money. But declining production coupled with low oil prices means managing it well is increasingly important if it's truly going to be permanent. On this program, we've heard from the governor, lawmakers, economists, and advocacy groups that all are saying the permanent fund has to be part of the formula and a smaller PFD as a result. Today, we have guests who say, not so fast. Joining me is former Senate President and longtime Republican State Senator and former House Member Rick Helford. Welcome.
Hi.
Thanks for being here. And also Brad Keithley. Brad is the president of Keithley Consulting, works on oil and gas issues.
Good morning, Lori.
Thanks for being here this morning. So let's get right to it. I also want to invite Alaskans to join us as well. They might have some thoughts about the budget process now that we're in a special session. Our call-in number is 1-800-478-8255. That's statewide, 1-800-478-TALK. Or if you're in Anchorage, you can call 550-8422, 550-8422, and you can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's get right into it. What do you want to see? Are you advocating against what a lot of state officials, state business leaders, and economists say is a must-have, a smaller PFD and using permanent fund earnings as part of a plan to balance the state budget? Who wants to jump in here first?
Well, of course,
former Senator Helford.
A coalition of the beneficiaries of the existing system has spent millions of dollars to define the word restructuring the permanent fund to mean cut the permanent fund in half. That's not really true. The permanent fund is not the first place we should go. We have a lot of other things to do long before we look to the most regressive way that we could possibly raise money only from Alaskans. It's just the wrong place to start. The place to start is to look at what we're giving away in credits first. The third largest expenditure of state government is paid out to companies, some of whom aren't even here yet because they want to carry it forward and wind it down. They're planning to come to look for a product that is not paying for itself in terms of the tax structure today, and in fact using some of the ownership income out of the royalty side. Our taxes are underwater because of the combination of credits, deductions, and carry forwards. And that's the first place to look. So the governor started out right. I think there are many other things to be done in reductions and in other taxes. But the bottom line is that the permanent fund should be the last thing put in the breach, not the first thing put in the breach. The proposals in combined impact take 90% of the benefit needed to keep state going at the current level from the permanent fund dividend revenue stream to Alaska citizens. That's the way to expand the recession from just the oil patch into the entire economy, according to the economists that are advising the state as well.
Why is it that you were in the House in the 70s, in the Senate in the 80s and into the 90s? Why is it that when plans are being developed, or maybe people do look at this, but this is my question to you, is when you are looking at developing a fiscal plan, oil and gas taxes are always part of the mix, of course. Do lawmakers say, okay, oil prices are here right now. What if they're down here in 10 years? Or what if they're, is that part of the conversation when you're looking at a tax plan? What's going to be the price that it's based on and what the impact will be in 5, 10, 15 years?
Well, rather than you know, look with the benefit of hindsight, I mean, when they established these things, they added credits on top of other credits for specific purposes in several different bills over a period of time. The credits weren't that significant, and the income was in the $5-7 billion range. So if you're getting that kind of income, it's not unreasonable to have 10% of your income possibly going into credits. But when the income dropped on the tax side to next to nothing and the credits overwhelmed the income, so now in terms of overall terminology, if it were not for the royalty, our tax system would be paying more than we're getting in. And if you look at the long-term projections, it doesn't look like it gets out from being underwater for several years. That makes it a pretty bad investment. There's no cost-benefit ratio in spending that kind of money, and it doesn't work when you compare oil tax credits in terms of saving the industry that really is driven by price, not by what we can do, to Alaska residents. I mean, it takes cutting the dividends of 130 people in half to support one oil industry job at the rate that the Department of Labor says the average cost is. It's not a very good equation for Alaskans.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we are back to discussing the budget and what role the permanent fund should or should not play and how the budget gets balanced. My guests are former Republican Senator Rick Helford and Brad Keithley, who is the president of Keithley Consulting. You can join our conversation at 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or in Anchorage 550-8422, 550-8422, or talk at alaskapublic.org by email. Brad, I want to get you in now. HB 311 was introduced in April. Sustainable budget reporting. What's the idea here?
Well, the idea is to go back to, frankly, something Governor Walker talked about during the campaign of 2014, which is to use the sustainable budget approach that Scott Goldsmith from the Institute of Social and Economic Research had been talking about for 5, 6, 7 years prior to that time. What Scott looked at is oil prices go up, oil prices go down, oil prices go back up, they go back down. And Scott's approach was to try to look through all of those peaks and valleys and develop a smooth price forecast and a smooth revenue forecast on which we could develop a sustainable budget. During periods when oil prices were high, we'd put the excess into savings. During periods when oil prices were low, we'd take the money out of savings and supplement to keep at that sustainable budget level. HB 311 is an approach to get the governor to have the governor and all future governors report what that sustainable budget number is based upon reasonable projections of oil price and production, and establish what a baseline of spending that we can sustain over time is. And then when we have revenues in excess of that, put it into savings. And when we have revenues below that, take it out of savings. That number, if we use that approach now, based upon what most oil economists are now forecasting as the appropriate forward price would be about $4.5, $4.3 billion. And that's the number that if we spent now, we could sustain, adjusted for inflation and population growth, going forward over time. That would mean right now we would need to pull some money out of savings. But when you look forward and see where oil prices are going, where economists are forecasting oil prices to go, when you look forward to the LNG project, even if you risk weight it a little bit, you can see that there are going to be periods of time then when we come out of that hole, we have revenues above that number and are able then to refill savings. HB 311 is the legislative means of capturing that idea and requiring the reporting that goes along with it.
So now that we're in a special session, it will take a pretty large vote, I think 3/4 vote, to resuscitate bills that died out at the end of the regular session. Have you heard where this piece of legislation may end up?
They're still talking. Representative Charisse Millett, who introduced HB 311 this morning on another program, talked about using it as the basis for an amendment to whatever fiscal package is being put together and require that reporting and use that as a baseline going forward. So it's prohibited from advancing on its own as HB 311, but there's nothing to prevent taking the substance of it and amending it and using it as an amendment into the fiscal package.
Mr. Helford, does this sound like the way forward to you?
Well, the starting point is that there's no emergency. We have a tremendous amount of reserves to make a reasonable transition. And going to the thing that has the most negative impact on the economy, taking from the permanent fund dividend, I mean, that's, you know, there's a lot of economic arguments about feeding the grassroots or trickle down. But the fact is that the permanent fund dividend feeds hundreds of millions of dollars into the grassroots of the economy of the state of Alaska. And whether it's braces for your kids, an education fund, whether it's all the rest of the economy is using the permanent fund income today. It's not a matter of creating something new. It's a matter of transferring from the grassroots of the economy into the trickle-down side of the economy, and that's not the place that we can save. I think what Brad is talking about is a responsible way to transition forward, and it makes economic sense, and it has the minimum economic negative impact on the rest of the economy. Alaska's economy is not in serious trouble. It's not like it was in the 80s when you had a housing catastrophe along with low prices. The Alaskan economy, in terms of lots of services, health care, a lot of things, is growing. Tourism is looking for a record year. So this is not the time to take out of the rest of the economy when you can't have nearly as much impact. I mean, the entire tax credit package of $1.5 billion when you combine credits, carry forwards, and payments is probably less in impact than a $10 change in the price of oil. We're trying to change something that the market overwhelms our effort in, and yet we can do some real damage by taking that money out of the private sector from individual private decisions.
Lori, let me pick up for a second on Rick's point that,
Brad Keithley, that
we're not in an emergency. We are telling ourselves that we're in emergency by the type of forecast that we're giving to oil prices and oil production. The governor's revenue projections that they came out with in the spring show $54 a barrel oil still in 2020. Most oil analysts that are out there now looking at this are saying $80. In 2020. And I know people look a little surprised at that, but what's going on is we have a historic amount of underinvestment going on in the industry. The amount of exploration that we have had this past year, you have to go back to 1951 to find as low an amount of exploration discoveries as we've had this past year. And as supply dropped, and that sort of activity is critical to developing supply going forward. So when you have this huge amount of underinvestment that's going on, the supply line in your typical supply-demand curve, the supply line is going to start dropping fairly fast. We're already seeing that underneath this overhang that we developed. Once we work off the overhang, we're going to see a significant supply drop. Demand is continuing to creep up. China's going up, India's going up, demand is continuing to go up. So we're going to have a big supply-demand gap that's showing up in the last half of this decade, 2018, 2019, which is going to have a price response. So that's where the $80 is coming from. People who are looking at the detail of what's going on the supply side and what's going on the demand side. So when Rick talks about there's not an emergency, there really isn't. We're in a trough, no doubt about that. Oil prices have been low, but that just sets up the next wave of price recovery.
But aren't we in that seesaw, though? Okay, so there's been a drop-off in investment partially because the prices have – there was a big supply that came online. Fracking was quite successful. then because of the huge glut of supply – the prices have dropped, and when that supply gets siphoned off, production will ramp back up again in a lot of places. Even fracking has they've fine-tuned their processes so that it's profitable at a lower rate than it was in the past. So won't we continue this back and forth of, okay, there's a lot of supply, so the price goes down. Now the supply gets siphoned off and the price goes up, and we stay in the seesaw. Don't we need to figure out how to get past that?
Which leads us exactly back to the approach that Governor Walker talked about in the 2014 campaign before he came into office, talking about using the sustainable budget approach that Scott Goldsmith developed, which is to get out of that seesaw by looking at a smooth line between those highs and those lows and to develop revenues based on that. You're exactly right. We do get into these seesaws, but there is a way out of it, and it's to use Goldsmith's sustainable budget approach.
All right. Well, we are talking about the budget and Alaska's future, and boy, oh boy, we have a lot of calls stacking up here. So let's start with Jim in Palmer. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
This is Jim Sykes from Palmer. The question I haven't heard asked much is, can we pay the full permanent fund dividend and still solve the fiscal gap and talk and do what Senator Halford was talking about, let the money flow through the economy first and claw some of it back, as my good friend Jay Hammond often said we needed to do? Can we actually do that?
All right. Thanks for the question, Jim.
The answer is absolutely yes. There is a large amount of money there. I mean, there. First of all, you gotta realize that when the boat is full of water, you gotta stop the leaks, and the leaks are currently the tax credits, and they make, because they're so big, they make a mockery of a lot of the efforts in small places to cut the budget when you're still paying out that massive amount of money. And they also discredit a lot of the efforts that people are genuinely making to make things work. That is something, that's a third of the total revenue shortfall is in tax credits, one third. That's just an astounding number. The permanent fund dividend system is the one thing that does work. The rest of government needs to make significant changes. But you can maintain the permanent fund formula as it exists today and solve the budget crisis. But you've got to start with the recognition that people need to think about paying for the services they get and not the continuous free ride. The oil industry is a major part of our past and a major part of our future, but it's not going to be the everything to our economy that it was in the past.
Well, I want to talk a little more about paying for the services, but let's go back to the phones here. Bernie is in Fairbanks. Hi, Bernie. Bernie?
Hi, Lori. How you doing?
Good. Do you have a question?
Well, I have a question slash a comment. One thing is, you know, I've been watching the debate over the last 2, 3, 4 years, you know, how things are going with the budget. And it'd be easier if people, if, you know, commentators and people talking to the public talk in percentages as opposed to $1 billion here, $2 billion there. So I know that we are looking right now at a budget that is going to be, what, including like $1 billion in revenue from the oil industry and oil, our oil production. And so we've got $3 million, which is, what, 75% going to have to come from somewhere else. So if I could have the panel comment on how can we get to $2 billion or $1.5 billion coming from, you know, the oil industry, what would we have to do, what would the legislator have to do to get that kind of revenue coming in so that, I mean, we're obviously going to have to use the permanent dividend fund. So that's one thing. So comment about that. How can we get more into the budget for that? And then the other thing is, when we use the permanent dividend fund, if we could have some mechanisms in place that it could be just a stopgap effort and that it's only for a short term until all these other things, all these other taxes and all these other regimes are put into place. I'd really appreciate that. Thank you so much for your panel and your time.
All right. Have a great day. Thanks, Bernie.
Thank you.
Who wants to jump in here?
One third of the revenue shortfall is in the credits. So that's a one third solution. That makes the reserves that we do have, which are substantial, last a lot longer. But that's, I think, the starting point, and I know Brad can go on from there.
Brad?
Well, we have roughly $13 billion in savings we will have at the end of this fiscal year. If you go on the sustainable budget path, if you do what Walker talked about during the 2014 campaign and the Scott Goldsmith approach, you supplement some of the shortfalls with those savings while we're below the $4.5 billion. We can get to the $4.5 billion. In fact, we were at the $4.5 billion. Both the budgets that were passed by the House and the Senate in March were roughly at $4.5 billion. They had about $73 million in those budgets for oil and gas tax credits. What's happened is oil and gas tax credits from March have gone from $73 million to $770 million, and that's what's sending us back down the road again. So Rick's exactly right. One of the first step in this is to cut those oil and gas tax credits back to the level that fits within the $4.5 billion. If we do that, and then we supplement with the savings we have, we don't need to cut the permanent fund dividend. We don't need taxes. We just continue at the sustainable level as oil prices recover, as production doesn't go down as fast as the governor has projected, and as we develop the future.
So when you talk about changing the oil tax regime, excuse me, again, do you have concerns that it makes our state government look a little schizophrenic because we put one plan in place and then a couple of years later another plan gets put into place? What would you propose for how to do this in a way that is not completely disruptive to businesses who are looking at a certain set of tax standards and policies here in Alaska and looking at their other investments around the world, deciding where they're going to put money in? What would that plan have to look like in order to offer some stability there, but also help us here in the state get out of this problem?
Well, when you talk about tax credits, you need to divide it into two pieces. One piece is the tax structure applicable to production and to producers. And SB 21 was really focused on setting that tax structure. It was put together based upon competitive considerations. What did we need to do in Alaska to remain competitive globally? And frankly, there's not been anybody who's challenged that competitiveness recently. So that's one thing. And frankly, I think we ought to keep that in place. The other is the reimbursed tax credits that we've developed that's paying non-producers, people who aren't yet in production, subsidizing their exploration and production activities to go out and look for things that may or may not be there. That's the program that has exploded, that has gotten out of hand. It started in the late 2000s at about $50 million to $100 million. That's the one that's now at $770 million. And when you look at that program, you need to look at it in terms of return on investment. If we'd left that money in the permanent fund or in the permanent fund earnings and allowed the permanent fund to invest it, it would have produced X. Are we getting at least that same return by putting it into oil and gas, these reimbursed oil and gas tax credits? That's the question we need to ask. And the answer, frankly, is no. We haven't had that sort of return. So that's the program that we need to go look at, and we need to ramp down significantly. And we start going forward, we need to look at it in terms of return on investment. Is paying this money out to X producer likely to produce a return equal to or greater than if we left it in the permanent fund?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Helford.
You've been around long enough to remember all the way back to the Hammond days when oil started to produce. And the agreement that Jay Hammond and the legislature and everybody kind of went forward with was a third of the value was going to end up in the state, a third of the value was going to go to the producers, and a third of the value was going to go to the federal government. The federal government at the time had a windfall profits tax. Their share went way down. But the state share has also gone way, way down. At current prices, they're producing $8 billion worth of oil today. There's some real question about where their profits are coming out. They're taking losses in Alaska. But remember, integrated companies can take the profit in the exploration side, in the production side, in the transportation side, in the refining side, in the marketing side. When we started out, we used a separate accounting method that dealt with their profits in Alaska for the product. And we should look at going back to get the credibility of really knowing what's happening in the industry by that kind of a process. But if the state were getting its one-third of $8 billion, there'd be, instead of $800 million coming in, there'd be something like $2 billion coming in. That's aside from the tax credit question. That's a long-term thing. That's not something that I'm saying you need to go back and get back into the Senate Bill 21 fight right now. You need to deal with the credits. But in the long-term solution, in the time we have, with the reserves we have in the next 2 or 3 years, we need to come up with a system that has real information. I mean, people are not very trusting of a system that is really allocated all over the world. And they don't know what the profit in Alaska is.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones quickly before we take a break. Hotai is in Valdez. Hello.
Hello. I want to thank both of you guys for your input. You're probably ruining a lot of the old My Squad's attitudes. The permanent fund shouldn't be touched. It doesn't belong to Walker or the state to touch. It belongs to the populace. And from my understanding, the populace is saying that, no way. I know my grandchildren don't owe the state their permanent fund, and they need to ask the children, do you want to give up your permanent fund? I don't think they have the right to do so. I appreciate both of you, and you've got some good points I didn't even know. So thank you a bunch.
All right. Well, thanks for your comments. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll take your calls as we continue our conversation about the budget and what the right mix of spending and revenue should be for the state into the future as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. With a rich curriculum from art to advanced engineering, over 10,000 alumni strong, 90% of their students go on to four-year colleges or other post-secondary education. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are discussing the budget and what role the permanent fund should or should not play in how we get to fiscal solvency. Former Senator Helford, Rick Helford, is one of our guests today, as is Brad Keithley with Keithley Consulting. And Senator Helford, you brought in something from 16 years ago, an election pamphlet. Tell us about what this is and also how it compares to today.
Well, when we last went to the ballot and let people weigh in on what was going to happen with the permanent fund, the advocates for cutting it in half, which would have made it about half as big today as it was then, had, you know, all the chambers of commerce and all the business leaders and all of the economic leaders of the state, and were successful at convincing only about 14% or 15% of the people to agree with them. But it's interesting that their presentation then was exactly as it is today. You know, they started out their ballot language with guarantee your dividend by voting yes to cut your dividend, just as restructure the permanent fund doesn't really mean cut the dividend. Vote yes and guarantee your dividend for decades to come is the first full sentence in the whole thing. But it goes on and it says how it's impossible to save the budget without taking the dividend. Of course, it was untrue then. If it had been done then, we would have been in much worse shape than we are today. Mm. And the private sector economy wouldn't have had the billions of dollars that went in from the bottom and caused all the growth in the rest of the economy of the state. It's not that much different today. And this was signed by three former governors, all of whom those that are still alive have been active in encouraging us to spend it today as they encouraged us to spend it then. One when he was in office in the mid-80s or late-80s proposed another spending measure which would have cut it in half from that point forward. But this is not a new effort. It's just that this time it's got a $5 million advertising budget.
We had an email question from Juanita in Eagle River, and she wants to know, do you think there is, the Alaska Future Group says their plans will protect the PFD. Do you think there is any protection for the PFD in the plans in Juneau now? And her second question, her follow-up is, what does it take to really protect the permanent fund dividend? So are there plans in Juneau right now that would protect the permanent fund dividend that you're observing, the two of you? And as her second question says, what does that take?
Well, number one, it doesn't protect the dividend. But worse than that, or at least as bad as that, it doesn't protect the fund itself. Because by divorcing the fund from the dividend, you essentially take away the political protection in the creation of that whole system. I mean, Elmer Rasmussen, Jay Hammond, a lot of leaders who had a lot of foresight put things in there. I know that Elmer's really, the first big fight was over the investment policy. Is it going to be a prudent investment policy or is it going to be a development fund? And then is there going to be inflation proofing? Those things are a big part of why the permanent fund is there today and is as valuable as it is today. But the third thing that Hammond put in there and everybody else worked with and went along with and made work through more evolution than somebody's bright idea. But the dividend itself is what has protected the permanent fund from the lack of public support. And it's, again, put huge amounts of money into the economy through private choices. You know, we have a constitution that mandates that the subsurface resources can never be disposed of. There's a lot of people from the libertarian ideology who would say that's a terrible socialist way to do it. But what the permanent fund dividend does is it privatizes the decisions on one quarter of that wealth that belongs to all Alaskans. Mm. And at least it gets some of it out into the private sector for individual decisions, which are economically much more effective in the economy, stay here longer, circulate longer, and go out in a very regionally balanced way.
Let's go back to the phones for just a moment. Noreen is in Nulato. Hi, Noreen.
Oh, hi. I was listening or watching on Facebook, too. I'm Noreen from Nulato. You know, years back, I said, you know, why not use the dividend to help pay for our debt? You know, the state debt has got a lot of money, but now I became a much older mama, a grandmother, an aunt to all those kids. You know, I got, like, 9 older sisters. And I'm saying, what I'm saying now is, you know, I realize things now. I want to tell these guys, don't bother the dividend. There's always something else you can use to get out of debt. Everybody's going with all kinds of businesses and marijuana. You're going to make lots of money. There's all kinds of people getting licensed for marijuana. Let them pay the taxes for a change, you know.
So don't
and
touch
the... And there's some villages.
Yes.
They're buying marijuana now. It's legal. You could use that tax money to help pay that deficit. Heck, man, if... You know, I told them, give them 2 years.
All right.
In about 2 years, with all those licenses for to sell marijuana, you'll be crawling out of debt.
All right. Thank you, Noreen, for your comment. I think that we need to make it clear that marijuana is not going to get us out of debt. So did you want to address that, Mr. Helfer?
Well, I just wanted to say that I did a research analysis request before I left the legislature, and it's hasn't changed much in population in the communities. Nolato, in the $1,000 reduction in dividends, Nolato would lose $352,000 in their economy, in the real local money that gets their economy, if the dividend were cut $1,000. I mean, that's
a big hit.
That's a big hit, and it's important to understand that the dividend goes out. It doesn't stay just in the regional centers. It goes all over the state. It is a grub stake. It is fuel. It is a lot of very important things to a lot of people that don't have a lot of government in their own area.
Mm-hmm.
Other than education, I think most people in rural Alaska would say that the most important thing they deal with the government for is their permanent fund dividend.
Absolutely, Brad.
To pick up on that point that Rick's been making in the follow-up on the call, the dividend, to evaluate what the economic effect is of cutting the dividend, you've got to make two assessments. One is, what's the economic effect of pulling that money out of the local economies?
Yes.
And then what's the economic effect of where you're going to spend it through the state? The ICER analysis that was done earlier this session that looked at those economic effects across the board said pulling the money out of the local economy had the most harmful effect. There wasn't anything you could spend it on at the state level that had even an equal to economic effect, much less a greater economic effect. So the state of Alaska is going backwards. The overall economy of the state of Alaska is going backwards if we cut the dividend. There are other things in the ICER analysis that frankly said, depending upon how you spend it at the state level, you actually could progress the overall economy. Income tax, sales tax had some slight progressive effect at it, depending upon how you spend it by the state. But across the board, pulling that money out of the private economy by cutting the dividend had a negative effect. Made government better, but the overall Alaska economy, taking into account the local effects that Rick's been talking about, is worse.
So Noreen from Nolato brought up the idea of taxing marijuana, that's going to save our bacon. We've seen the projections of what that will bring in. Even very wild, optimistic estimates are small amounts of millions of dollars we're talking about, rather than the billions that's needed for the state. All of our other revenue sources currently combined, tourism, mining, fishing, everything, doesn't get us where we need to be. So you've lined out some of the areas that are the biggest places, the credit system and restructuring that system for the oil industry. Why is it so hard when you're laying it out? Sounds quite clear. Why is it so hard to get there for the legislature? Why can't this happen?
Well, just remember that the permanent fund dividend changes are a tax. They're the most regressive Alaskan-only tax that's targeted to families and children that we could possibly ever pass. But there are taxes that can help. I mean, the fact is that the federal government reports over $23 billion of adjusted gross income coming from Alaska. If you had a real income tax, and I hate taxes just like anybody else, but if you're putting everything on the table, you have to look at it. The capacity in an average income tax at the average of the states from the revenue that's in Alaska is about $1 billion. So looking at a very, very low proposal by the governor is not what the income tax average would be. You could generate $1 billion at about 6% income tax, and that should be on the table as well. It's a big number. It's not the little numbers they're talking about. And those are the kind of things that the future is going to bring, and they will also make people decide what they want to spend their money on. We've had a complete generation of people able to go to the restaurants and order without any prices on the menu. There's prices on the menu for the future, and people have to decide what they're willing to pay for.
Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Charlie is in Sitka. Hi, Charlie.
Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Do you have a comment or a question?
Yes. Well, comment about the dividend is it's going to be a huge hit on the economy if they eliminate it by wasting it, by handing it over to politicians. I think one thing that hasn't been discussed is it just really bugs me is term limits and the amount of money that we pay politicians after they retire. I mean, I look at the wages. I keep hearing all these people that are representing me telling me how they feel my pain, and yet they're making 4 to 5 times as much as I am yearly, basically for the rest of their lives. I often wonder how much money would be saved if, as a nation even, if we installed term limits and started getting people in those seats that represent the people that that hired them by voting, and get them out of there when they're done and let them get on to having a real life like the rest of us Americans.
All right. Well, we have a former lawmaker right here in the studio and also a consultant. So, Mr. Helford, former senator.
I'll use myself as an example.
Please do.
I went to the system when it paid about $10,000. And basically, the legislative service takes about half a year in terms of what it is to your life because you've got lots of meetings and a lot of other things you do. But I spent 24 years in the process, and I think my retirement, of course, when you turn 65, the medical becomes basically almost worthless, so that doesn't do any good. And I think my retirement is something in the neighborhood of about $1,850 a month after 24 years in the process. I don't think that particular system at that time was excessive at all. But we have increased the salaries. The per diem, I think, is something that people need to look at. But, you know, if you're going to get people to go, they're going to be competent people and not just either retired and don't need the money or so young that they don't have any obligations. If you're going to get people with families and people from the middle of the spectrum, you've got to pay at least a reasonable wage. I don't like some of the things they're doing. I don't like some of the things they're spending their money on. But I do believe that the pay scale at the state level is not unreasonable. I just wish they would earn it a little better.
All right, Mr. Keithley.
I don't think this is about term limits, and I don't think this is about individual legislators, what they're doing or not. What we've done in this state through the programs we've developed in the past is we've developed a bunch of people who are dependent on special programs. Let's just take oil and gas tax credits as an example. The reimbursed oil and gas tax program doesn't exist anyplace else in the world.
I wanted to ask about that. I'm glad you brought that up because I wanted to get to a question about how do we compare to other places. So thank you for that.
But it doesn't exist anyplace else in the world. But we created it. We've created it through incrementally. We started it in 2002 under Governor Knowles, then we expanded it in 2007 under Governor Palin, then we expanded it again under Governor Parnell, and now we've got this monster out there that has all of these special interests tied to it and are going to the legislature and saying, oh, don't cut this because, you know, we've built up this entire industry around it. That's repeated in all sorts of different places. I don't think if you had term limits and you change legislators out, it would change the end result at all. You would still have lobbyists and special interests going down there, convincing whoever's down there. They're trying to convince whoever's down there to change these programs. What we need to do in my opinion, is what Governor Walker talked about in the 2014 campaign, which is to have a spending cap reflecting what the state's long-term revenue position is that cuts through the highs and the lows, sets a sustainable budget level, and then we can fight about what's inside that spending cap. But until we do that, we're going to have special pleading for this program or that program or that program, and at the end of the day, it's going to add up to what we've got now, which is excessive spending. We've got to set the spending cap and then live within it.
So the Norwegian ambassador was here recently in Alaska talking about their sovereign wealth fund, which is $800 billion. And he said when they first started talking about how they were going to implement their tax plan for the oil industry, the industry said, if you do that, we're going to leave. And he said, well, we did it anyway, and they didn't leave. Why is it so hard for lawmakers here to change this, what you're describing as kind of the elephant in the room, this credit system that needs to be changed? Are we too timid and worried about what will happen in the future with what is, of course, 90% of our revenue stream right now? Are lawmakers too timid with the oil industry? Why can't we get this work done?
Well, surprisingly, Lori, we don't have a lot of knowledge about the oil industry in the state outside of the oil industry. We have a lot of people who comment on it. But when you think about ICER doesn't have an oil economist on staff. There isn't anybody in the state who really understands the industry. So we get into these situations where, let's address tax credits. So we bring in a bunch of outside consultants that don't understand Alaska, are here during a legislative session, talk about whatever they talk about, and then they leave again. Then we bring another set in the next time we want to talk about it. We don't have a good set of oil consultants inside the state that are looking at this issue on an ongoing basis from an Alaska perspective. So that's part of the problem. And then the other part of the problem is we get these special deals going, like the credits going. And not only do we get producers dependent on them, we get the support industry, the supply industry dependent on them. And then they come in and lobby and say, oh, no, you can't cut that because that revenue is something, or that spending is something that we're dependent on now. So we don't have a good overview of what's going on in the oil industry inside the state, outside of the oil companies. And we create these special programs that people then get vested in and try to maintain.
Senator Helfert.
It's not even public information who's getting the credits. But the fact is that the oil support industry gets a huge amount, most of the money out of the credits. And that's also embedded throughout the state in strange ways through the regional corporations and through their shareholders. And then the conflict is between their shareholders and the people who are not shareholders of those corporations from the same communities that are younger. I mean, you've got a lot of things built into this that can create all kinds of long-term questions. It is a huge amount of money, and in some cases, there's tens of millions of dollars going to very small corporations for a lot of expenditures, some of whom haven't got here yet. Mm. They're still coming from outside, out of an industry that hasn't got a lot of their options, to a unique program that can put them to work at our expense.
Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Glenn is in Copper Center. Hi, Glenn.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I want to talk about the regressive tax that this creates. I know you guys talked about how it would impact poor families in the rural area and other poor families around the state. But it seems like we have a lot of regressive taxes out there, you know, like taxes on alcohol and cigarettes is a regressive tax. And I don't know what kind of studies you've done on what income tax would do, but there are a lot of rich people out there that are making a lot of money, and a decent proportion of them are not really going to stay here in Alaska when they retire. So I'll just throw that out.
All right. Thanks, Glenn. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll take more calls and talk with our guests about Alaska's budget as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. GCI, an Alaska-born and raised company connecting Alaskans from the Aleutian to the Arctic, from the North Slope to Southeast and to the rest of the world. With more than 2,000 employees statewide, a proud supporter of Alaska Public Media. And by
ExxonMobil Alaska, working with more than 100 Alaska communities and thousands of Alaskans. Today, ExxonMobil is producing natural gas condensate from the Point Thompson facilities.
All right, here we go. We are talking about the budget and getting all kinds of ideas. We had an email question here that says, if or when oil rebounds, where will there be action taken to create another fund similar to a sovereign wealth fund that could help pay for government expenses down the road? Will we learn from this lesson? Do we need another fund?
Well, the answer is we need two things. One is we need a spending cap so that we don't do what we did from 2011 through 2013, which is to spend everything that came in the door. But secondly, we don't need another fund. The Constitutional Budget Reserve is a loan fund. Under the Constitution, when you take money out, you have an obligation to pay it back. There's not a time frame within which you have to pay it back, but you have an obligation when you have excess to put that money back into the CBR until the CBR fills back up to its original level. So we've got a way to do that. We've got a fund to do that. We just need the will and indeed the statutory restrictions and perhaps constitutional restrictions ultimately on spending to make sure when we have that additional revenue that we put it back into those funds.
When we were first talking about concern over the budget a year and a half or so ago, and people really started to have this conversation, there was a lot of push for cut government. Would you say, Senator Helford, would you say that that's been done? And are you satisfied with the cuts that have been made? Or do lawmakers need to continue looking at that?
Well, they need to continue looking at that. But there have been a lot of reductions made. But when you're making reductions, when you're cutting the University of Alaska $50 million and you're putting out $750 million in tax credits to outside entities and to a lot of the upper side of the economy, it doesn't look very good. So that the reductions are still an important part of the debate, but the tax credits color everything else because they're such a huge expenditure. They're the third largest expenditure paid out in state government. But I wanted to come back to your sovereign wealth fund statement because it's important to understand the sovereign wealth concept is totally different than the permanent fund. Sovereign wealth funds spend their principal when necessary, when their income doesn't cover their payout. A sovereign wealth fund concept as applied to the permanent fund and carried forward would be unconstitutional under the permanent fund constitutional amendment. There is no provision in the permanent fund to ever spend principal without amending the Constitution. Mm-hmm. A sovereign wealth fund is the government's fund, the very statement. It's the king's money. It's the leadership's money. The permanent fund is a people's fund, and it is for the future. It wasn't to be a rainy day account. They used the word permanent very carefully and very meaningfully. It was intended to pass that value on to the next generation that didn't have the incredible wealth that we still have in oil.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones for a quick call here. Helen is in Bethel. Hi, Helen.
Good. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to say that the permanent fund enhances our economy and makes us richer as families and for our future generation. If we cut that out, we won't get any more other revenue other than the land resources and oil resources and fishing industry and touring. We need to keep this permanent fund for our Alaskans who will stay in Alaska and not move down south. We need to support not taking that money from permanent fund dividend. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Helen, for that very definitive statement on the impact of the PFD, especially in rural Alaska.
The proposed reduction would take $6 million out of Bethel.
You've lined out the majority of the villages? Is that right? You've got this analysis?
What I did is I made a research request before I left in 2002, and population hasn't changed that much, mm-hmm. and it just it gives what happens community by community with a $250, a $500, a $750, and a $1,000 reduction in dividends. The proposal it was initially started with was a reduction of more than $1,000 in the dividend. So it would be at least those numbers. But that's a legislative research report that's in the legislative system. I can give you the numbers. Anybody can look it up and look community by community what the impact of cutting the dividend is.
So we've talked about the oil credit system that both of you have said needs to be revised. What else? We only have about 2 minutes left here. What else needs to be in the mix here for getting the state on better fiscal footing for the future?
Well, I think the university system is something that has been a focus all along. I think Jim Johnson is doing a great job of beginning to get the university system turned around, talking about making it one university as opposed to three universities, cutting that overhead, getting it much more dynamic. I think we're in process on that, but we need to make sure that that's a delivered item. I think, frankly, we need to go back and look at Medicaid. Medicaid is about $600 million total the state spend. About half of that is mandatory programs that's required by the federal government. The other half, frankly, is optional programs that we've opted in over time. Alaska alone among all the states has opted into every optional Medicaid program. There are states like Nevada and Arizona that haven't opted into any. And that's a $300 million item. Those optional programs is a $300 million item that, frankly, we need to go look at. K through 12 probably could take some looking at. There's other places to look. Frankly, the legislature had done a fairly good job of doing that. They'd gotten spending in the March budgets down to $4.5 billion. They'd made some cuts, about $385 million in cuts. But what's happened is oil and gas tax credits has just swamped that away mm-hmm. and turned what was a $385 million reduction into a $400 million addition as a result of oil tax credits. So that's what we need to be looking at.
Senator Halford in the final moment here.
Start with tax credits. I would look to going back to the original agreement with the oil industry for one-third, 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 which was what was happening through the 70s and 80s as production started. I would look at a transparent accounting system so we knew exactly what was happening, not just with the credit system, but with an accounting for what profits are made on oil in the state of Alaska based on Alaskan operations. And I think we have to look at individual taxes. People have to have a stake in what they want through their own economic situation.
Skin in the game.
Yes.
All right. Thanks so much to my guests, former Senate President Rick Halford and Brad Keithley of Keithley Consulting. Thanks to all of our calls. We didn't get to a lot of them. They're still on the line. So sorry we didn't get to those calls, but thanks for joining us. I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks for calling in.
Made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network.
Commercial, sport, subsistence, personal use. Some hear these labels and think conflict. The Salmon Project sees connections. Join 10,000 Alaskans whose lives are connected by Alaska's salmon. Visit salmonlife.org to experience the stories. And find the Salmon Project on Facebook to join the community. Salmon Life, Salmon Love. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project. The MBA program at Alaska Pacific University provides working professionals an educational pathway to career advancement. Through APU's hybrid course format of online and campus-based courses, students can focus on healthcare, finance, technology, and strategic leadership options. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.